Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast. We're continuing to share our stories and interviews with Canadian ceramic artists here in 2026. And today on the podcast, I'm joined by Heidi McKenzie, a Toronto-based ceramic and installation artist whose work sits at the powerful intersection of clay, image, memory, and history. Heidi's practice is deeply informed by her mixed race, Indo-Trinidadian and Irish-American heritage, and working across ceramics, photography, digital media, and archival imagery, she explores themes of ancestry, migration, race, colonization, and healing, often through abstract portraiture and the use of image as archive. Her work has been exhibited internationally and collected by major institutions, including the Royal Ontario Museum and Global Affairs Canada. In 2023, her solo exhibition, Reclaimed, Indo-Caribbean Her Stories at the Gardner Museum, brought forward the little-known histories of Indo-Caribbean indentureship through a feminist lens. In this conversation, we talk about ceramics as a vessel for memory, the ethics of image making, holding space for marginalized histories, and how clay can function as both archive and witness. It's a rich and moving discussion, I think, about identity, belonging, and the quiet power of material storytelling. So please welcome Heidi to the show, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Heidi, thanks so much for joining us on the Color and Ceramics podcast. We are excited about having you on board here, a fellow Canadian doing some really exquisite and very interesting work out of Toronto, Ontario. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bob. I'm thrilled to be asked.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And, you know, one of the things that we usually start off our podcast interviews with is having our folks tell us a story about their journey. And so I'm sure you didn't start this just yesterday. And so there's a bit of a journey and story behind what you do. And in fact, maybe that's a wide open question because much of your work is about story and about your background and your family's backgrounds and the challenges of immigration and so on. So, but I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your journey in clay.
Sure. It is kind of wide open. I'll just, when I turned 40, so this is not my first career, my mother gave me a school paper I wrote when I was 10 years old. And it said all about me, and it was 21 pages handwritten, and there were 4 pages about how I wanted to be a potter when I grew up. And I honestly had completely forgotten, completely. You know, in the arts, I started in music. I went to arts management, festival management, production, radio, fundraising in the arts, all kinds of things. But never in my wildest dream did I imagine that I would be a visual artist. I never even took art in high school. And I guess I had known that that's what I wanted to do. And I was 10 and it was like a lightning bolt. And I was consulting at the time and I contacted everybody and I dropped everything. And I went off to India and apprenticed with one of India's foremost potters for 3 months at the foothills of the Himalayas. And let me tell you, changed my life and never looked back.
I bet. Why India? Now tell us about why you went to India to do your training.
Well, as it happens, I married a man who grew up in India. And when this lightning bolt happened to me, he said, why don't you go work with Minnie? Because this was his childhood friend's father. And I called him up and he said, well, I have a 3-month apprenticeship program. It's usually booked up years in advance, but someone just dropped out. There's one spot. Can you come in 3 weeks? And I thought, well, there's fate. Absolutely. Offering me an opportunity. And off I went.
Yeah. It's funny how that happens, eh? The gods seem to align and things happen for us when we have a good intention. So that's awesome.
So can I tell you another part of the story? Because it does unfold a little bit more, I think, related to that specific question, which is that Okay, so I went to school, I went to Sheridan, I got my degree. I decided it wasn't going to be a hobby. I wanted to do an MFA. I did that. And then I went to Australia because I had met Shoji Mitsu in China as a demonstrating artist. And he is an artist who grew up in Japan and has been living in Australia in Sydney. And I wanted to work with him, and I got a grant, and I went off to Australia for 3 months. And then I got the consul general of the cultural consul general in Sydney offered me the opportunity to go to the interior and to meet with the Aboriginal ceramic artists. And then that was pivotal for me because what I realized they were doing is telling their stories on their art. And I thought, aha, that I have so much that I want to say through my art. I've studied race relations. I've done a lot of work and research around my own different heritage. Both my Indo-Caribbean heritage and my Irish heritage, pre-famine and post-famine in Ireland. And so I have a lot of stories to tell about those folks, and that's when I made that shift to telling narrative stories through my art installation work.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. You also use photography a lot in your
Yes.
work, right? So can you tell us a little bit about how you started to integrate photography into your storytelling?
Yes. It started right after grad school at OCAD University. And I kind of, my friends joke with me. They say, Heidi's, become a potter and see the world. I love to go to residencies, and I've been fairly lucky with grants. And so I had gone to this place called, I'm not sure people are going to write in and tell you I didn't say it right. Guyagah.
Well, that sounded okay to me, Heidi. Yeah.
in Denmark, and it was for ceramic artists who had just finished a degree and to come together from all over the world. Anyway, I went there, and I realized that I was going through a lot of physical health challenges at the time, and I realized I wanted to tell that story. And I'm an abstractionist at heart, and so I decided to take photographs of my body and literally put the images on clay. And I didn't know anything about putting image on clay. And I literally started by taking black and white photographs and gluing them on with Elmer's glue onto Limoges porcelain. And luckily, I heard about Paul Scott and his work with photography and image on ceramics, and I just kind of really never looked back. And so I've been working with, and I have to say, though, I guess it was 2016, I did a pivotal piece around my father's body and documenting his legacy just at the end of his life. And through, as a result of doing that piece, where one side was color photographs of close-ups of his body with various physical evidence of things in his past, scars and so on. The other side had photographs, which I called memory images at the time. Now, my father was an amateur photographer. He was a scientist, but he was an amateur photographer. And when we cleared out his office, there were some 8,000 slides. And we were only able to find less than two dozen with him in them because he took most of the photographs. And so I had these few images of him throughout his life. And my parents were married for 10 years before children came into the picture. So they had a whole kind of life there. And I put some of these images that sort of documented his move from the Caribbean to Canada. And I realized I was calling the memory images, and then I realized, oh, this iron oxide color we get when we fire on laser decals is this beautiful, rich blood red, which evokes archival image. It evokes sepia tone of archive image. And that's when I had another huge, so that was 2016. I had this aha moment that I really like to work with my archive, my family's archive. And so I started doing that, and I ended up by 2019, I had sort of a collection of work around family. I called Family Matters, and I've worked extensively with my family archive on both sides. And then from there, it started rolling out into realizing that I wanted to tell larger stories of so not only my father's story, but of the story of Indo indentureship. I'm not sure if you know that. Not it's a, it is kind of a little known story that the Indians came and replaced the African slaves in the West Indies to take over the sugar plantation for the British in the 19th and early 20th century. So that's my father's heritage, and then also my mother's heritage, and they came over almost exactly the same time. My ancestors came from India to Guyana and Trinidad in the 1860s, and my father's side and my mother's side, they came from Ireland to Canada in also in the 1860s. So those are the stories, and they were flax farmers, and they were, laborers. So there's a lot of there are things in common. And I started to do a lot of visual research, as well as, academic reading research. But photography was just central to telling the stories. I mean, as a visual artist, image is story.
Absolutely. We have some similarities. My family's from Ireland as well, who came over about the same time, and they were weavers who came over as part of that whole story. So I understand a tiny little bit, I guess, of what you're talking about. I'm kind of interested in this notion of using photography and telling stories, and you have a lot of exhibitions you have your work in and so on. And I'm wondering around the whole notion of the boundaries around a story. And like it seems to me that we could have a story that goes on forever. And some artists I know would maybe produce the same kind of work and tell the same kind of story for years. And others do it in short little bits. Where do you fit? Do you have a more of a circumscribed notion to a story? Or how does that work for you?
Well, that's a really good question. I guess I kind of find usually when I'm working on what I would call a narrative installation piece, and I've only really done three solo exhibitions, but I've done individual pieces. But if I'm doing a whole exhibition, it does take me 2 to 3 years of research. And how I hang on to a story or define the story boundaries is really about what kind of grabs me about the story and how I can find a personal connection. So it's not necessarily defined by a timeline. It's more about the impact of the personal resonance for me. So let me just give you two examples briefly. The first time I did a lot of work in archive, I had been in Medicine Hat at Midalta, which is kind of, I'm sure you know where you
Sure
are.
happened. I sure do, yeah.
Yes. So I was there in the coldest winter on record in 2019 for a residency. I was building big in their big kilns. And while I was there, I did a tour with Al. Everybody knows Al. I'm trying to remember his last name, who was the foreman there at the IXL Brick Factory. And it was minus 30, and he spent 4 hours giving us a really detailed tour of the factory. And as I was there, I was really visually excited by the old architectural bricks. Like the shapes just really caught my imagination. And then as he was describing the hardship of the labor of working the factory, I realized that it just hit me that my father had told me that in the 50s, he worked as a brick mason at Stelco in Hamilton. And one of the reasons he was in the brick, as a brick mason at Stelco and in the furnaces was because the prevailing belief at the time was that the darker your skin, the more heat you could withstand. And I just thought, wow, I wonder what happened here. I mean, the railway was pivotal, as you know. There were several Chinese had settled. It was a huge indigenous community there. What happened in terms of the because and then the brick making and pottery making was the livelihood of a huge percentage of the community. Where were the people of color and the indigenous people? And so I delved into that. So that was, it was that personal residence that got me to research. And it turns out that the research defined the timeline, 1896 to when the factory closed in 2011, I believe. And then I guess the show that I've just put up in Montreal, it took me a really long time to figure out what I had to say to Montreal. Because it's really important for me to engage the audience, to use image, ceramics, and form to kind of destabilize people's way of seeing the world. And I didn't want to do something inauthentic. I wanted to have my own way in. And then it hit me about a year and a half ago that after my father had passed, but before my mother passed in 2020, she mentioned to me that my father had been involved in the race riots in Montreal. And long story short, that was my way in to that show. Well, I guess I do have to tell you, it was a very different way of looking at that situation in 1969, the race riots, the Black Power movement, the student protests. And my father went to, it turns out, did his PhD at Western with the fellow who was accused of academic racism that catalyzed the whole explosion of the riots and actually was a character witness for him. So that was very destabilizing for me to come to terms with that and to know that my father knew I had dedicated much of my adult career to equity and diversity and inclusion and had done my thesis around race and identity, and that he had read it and he'd never mentioned to me that he had been involved in these things. So yeah. So that's that there is a timeline to that story. To answer your question, but really it's more about the personal reaction and feeling.
So if I think of it visually, I guess I can see you entering into a story through your own personal experience or understanding of family or culture. And then once you're into the story, so it might take you quite a while to develop that story. So you might have the aha moment of getting that spark to start to think about, oh, that's where I could touch here. And then you've got this long period where you do research, and it sounds like you've been pretty successful with grants and so on to help you be able to do that. And maybe we could touch on how to do that a bit later. But I also I'm hearing you talk about how you want your work to touch people. And of course, we know that art doesn't end when we pull a piece out of the kiln. The work continues on with the people who view it, and that's part of the process. Is there a way that you engage those people? Like, so you make your piece. How do you engage people to have a reaction to your piece? Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I mean, I think, clearly and obviously, firstly, there's the one-on-one engagement. If people come to the
Sure.
show and I'm there and I can speak to them, magic can happen. Two things happened in Montreal while I was in the gallery, and one couple had made an effort to come because the woman had been arrested during the event for handing out flyers. And she wanted to tell her story from her perspective to me, which was great. But that's the one thing that happens is if you tell a
Absolutely.
story, somebody has a story to tell you back. And so that is engaging. And then the other thing that happened is, and I documented that story because you never know. And then the other thing that happened there was a woman and her husband came in off the street. Randomly, they saw the gallery open. They were visiting from the States, and she identifies as a African American. And I gave them the tour, and she just wrote to me yesterday this long note about her personal connection to her family and her family's history of protest and fighting marginalization and racialization in Cabo Verde. And I was just like, wow, so amazing. So there's that. I mean, I'm hoping that people will feel called to look at their own stories, but I'm also hoping that because the stories I'm trying to tell are little known stories, that there are a lot of people who will just kind of stop and think. And that also is happening. That they'll really have not have heard of this or wonder or I mean, one of the most exciting times that I had with a group of people was the Friends of South Asia, the ROM, the Royal Ontario Museum, came as a group to see my exhibition on Indo-Caribbean Her Stories. And I don't know, 20 or 30 people were there. 9 out of 10 of them were of South Asian descent, but none of them were of Caribbean descent, but all of them had things that they could relate to. And so that was so exciting. And they were learning about a part of their history that they didn't know anything about.
It
I don't know
really,
if I
it,
answered your question.
yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the thing that I hear you talking about is that the art creates an opportunity to have a personal conversation or connection with a person or persons, and in and around the theme of your work, right? And really, as I see you light up on the screen here, I mean, everybody will not see the screen because this is an audio-only podcast, but I see your energy come up when you talk about that, and that's the component that finishes the work for you in a way.
Well, and can I also say, I think it's just amazing the serendipity that happened out of that show, the Indo-Caribbean Her Stories. I didn't set out to do a piece about my own personal history. I set out to highlight women's role in the struggle for rights and to stop child labor and, working conditions and increased wages and so on, and indentureship through a feminist lens. But then I thought hard and I decided, okay, well, I will include myself as one of the 10 women whose stories are told. And as a result of doing that, I wrote an article about it, or I was interviewed about it, and things were published. I don't know where to start. I'm going to again try and be brief. The month after the show opened, I get an email saying, this is going to be sound out of the blue, but my husband and I were just visiting from the States. I'm here for a conference. We went to the Gardner. We saw your show. I think my husband is your first cousin. And it turns out he
He
is.
is, yeah.
His mother was the youngest. My father was the oldest of 17. They didn't know each other. And, now I know my new cousins, and I went this Labor Day to meet my aunt, who's 85. And then, but additionally, moreover, I wrote something, was invited to write something that got published in a Guyanese online newspaper. And someone in New York State read it and thought, huh, and sent it to my cousins in Fort Lauderdale, who thought, oh, yeah. And they contacted me, she contacted me, my woman in her late 40s, and said, this might sound out of the blue, but. We just heard about your show and we think we're related. And it turns out that they are my cousins once removed. And sort of in the 1912, 1913, the Muslim side of my father's family stayed in Guyana. And my great grandfather went to Trinidad and left Islam, became a Christian slash Hindu. And the two sides had never been together. And now I have another 15 cousins all over. Who are of Muslim heritage, who are calling me, embracing me, welcoming me into their family, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
So that was completely unexpected.
that's fantastic. It really is that your work and the idea of sharing stories creates sort of a web of connections with people. And that's what I hear you talking about, that through your work of writing and doing the artwork and so on and so forth, that you were able to really broaden your connections with your family.
That's with my family and with community. Yes.
That is awesome. Hey, I wonder if we could maybe take a little bit of a turn and talk
Sure.
a bit more technical about your work.
Yeah.
So I think people have got now a good sense of of you. And of course, we'll put up in our show notes links to your website and so on, so they can really start to dive into some of your work. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about maybe some of your techniques and how you're approaching your work, particularly with clay, because that's kind of what we're all about. You use photograph. How do you use photographs or your multimedia approach with clay now?
Well, I recently this summer I actually took a course, a 6-week course on digital collage, and that's really catapulted me into this most recent exhibition in terms of my, well, I have been working, sort of painstakingly with Photoshop, but now I'm anyway working a little bit more in trying to work with scrapbooking looks and ripping printed images in a very analog way, then scanning them and then working with them digitally and then having them generated as decal. And I have been working almost exclusively with decal. I've started recently screen printing and what's the word I'm looking for? Manipulating the clay. So screen printing on a sheet of clay and then kind of crumpling it up and obscuring the image. And also, very recently, I've started playing with cyanotype printing and exposure, like going back to the first kind of methodologies of producing photography. So that blue cyanotype on porcelain. So those are some of the ways I want to continue working with screen printing. And now I'm thinking, well, I'd like to work with different ways of creating image on clay on the same pieces and layer that. And I mean, I think there's just so much there, as we know, in clay, there's an infinite number of possibilities.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If you were to advise somebody who wanted to get into that, because like most people are, I think, applying, slips or glazes to functional work. Like that's the vast majority of folks who are doing that. But I could see a number of people who might really be intrigued with what you're doing and have their own story and might want to do that. Where might you suggest they start with the whole notion of applying images to clay?
Well, that's a good question. Just to point out, I've never been someone who's interested in glaze. I learned the glaze chemistry, and I have made pots and glazed pots, but from the get-go, I've been really interested in raw clay. So even when I, not raw clay, but raw unglazed surfaces, vitrified surfaces. So when I put image on clay, it's almost always unglazed. Where would and also I think I went from nariage, unglazed nariage, to photography. I didn't really go through a glaze phase. I think and so color, to your point, colored clay is where I started. I'm sitting here looking at one of my colored clay mugs. I think what could I recommend? I mean, I think the easiest thing is to start is would be to start playing with ceramic decal on glazed functional ware, on clear glazed. But to start to immediately think outside the box, like what is your story? If your story is, you're telling st stories through your functional line and your functional line is blue and white, then try putting some photographs that are meaningful to you. What's most meaningful to you? It doesn't have to be a photograph. It could be a drawing, could be a sketch. It could be clip art. It could be anything, animation, any image. And to sort of, I've taught courses on this, and I encourage people not to just go out and get their ancestors' photos and print them and put them on their ceramics, because that's what I do. Do what you do. What do you do? What rocks your world, and figure out what that is, and maybe I don't know. I'm just looking at this collection of artifacts in front of me. Maybe that's what it is, and maybe you get images of objects that you want to put on your objects, or maybe whatever it is.
Yeah. So I guess I hear you saying the technique is not as important as the story. Like the story is really the key thing, and that you really need to dive deep into yourself and your experience and your environment to identify the story that's most important to your heart that you want to share at the moment, and then the technique, whatever it might be in terms of images, there's such a range, you can start to play around with those. But you really need the story first.
Yes, I think so. I think you're a really good listener and able to sort of translate, read between the lines there. You know, when I taught this course, I taught a course at the University of Manitoba Ceramics Program last year, and I asked people to come with to send in their photographs that they'd like to use for tests. And you know, 5 out of 6 people sent in pictures of their cats. I thought, wow, people really haven't dug deep. They really don't, they don't know what is really moves them. And I think that is the first step.
It's interesting. I don't have any tattoos, but lots of people, of course, do these days. And I'm really interested in why people choose a particular image for they put on their body that's going to be there permanently. And so I'll often ask, "Hey,
Yes.
that's cool. Why did you choose that one?" And it's interesting the answers that people give you, and it ranges from the cat stories to something more profound.
That's a very good analogy, Bob. I think that's a great analogy. If you're making that kind of decision to put something permanently on your body, you will have thought about it.
Well, surprisingly, lots have not. So, just like your cat story. That's awesome. Hey, you brought up grants a few times, and one of the things that we'd like to do with this podcast is to highlight top professionals like yourself and get the word out more in the world, and help you in that regard, but also get some ideas from you that could be of benefit to our audience who are potters and ceramicists, painters, and so on. And grants are important because grants often give you the cash to be able to go and fulfill an idea in some way. You talked about going to Australia as an example with a grant. I've been happily successful at getting grants, and I know there's certain strategies about how to get grants. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your experience and what you think is important for people who might start to take that approach.
Right. Well, I guess I would go back to telling stories.
I knew you were
But
going
you
to
knew I was going to say,
say
well, but the thing is, you know, I had the great fortune in my life
that.
to, well, I was a professional fundraiser for a while, and then so that's about communicating ideas succinctly. And that ex was extremely helpful. But then when I worked in radio, boy, that was really, you know, you got 5 minutes. What are the key points you're going to pull out for your host? What are the questions that need to be asked? What are the to really compress and find those hooks very quickly. And you know, people talk almost glibly about the elevator pitch, but really, if you can pull your idea into a few sentences and then half a page and then a full page to flesh it out, you're in really good shape. And, you know, I have applied a number of times to the Winifred Chance Award here at the Canadian Clay and Glass Gallery. I did once make it to the finalist list, and now I'm beyond, you know, I'm outside of the parameters of emerging, so I no longer have applied or am applying. But every single time I applied, it focused me on an idea, and every one of those ideas I took to different granting agencies, and in some form or another, I had funded. So, that to me tells me how powerful it is to spend the time to synthesize your story into, like, you can have an idea, and it can be fantastic, but if you can't translate it into words, maybe you really can't translate into words, but maybe you could talk to somebody who is good at doing that, and they can help you put it into words, because not everybody is a writer. And that is really the way our system works. I've been a juror. I'm currently in the middle of jurying something right now. And you know, when you're jurying something, you often have dozens, if not hundreds, of files to go through. You got to grab that person in the first few sentences. So that's be my advice.
Absolutely. And often I think Artists and potters and ceramic artists will have a million different ideas. And so we might be sitting in our studio and going, oh, that's interesting. And oh, that's interesting. And then they have to find a way to eliminate almost all of the ideas that percolate in their mind and drive us crazy. And then focus in on something. But you also talked about the value in connecting with others that you could bounce those ideas off of and to help get that idea, to hone that idea, I guess, and be able to put that in words that are clear and succinct and can hook the reader.
Yeah, hook the reader who's often a juror. I would also say what's important is I know to a lot of people just wait. They just think, well, next year I'll be ready to write a grant. Next year or next year. And then years go by. And they don't feel, because you're right, all of us artists have a million ideas, and it's very hard to focus and sort of really get a razor sharp vision of where we're going. And I don't know that any artist can do that. Maybe some. Think about Laurent Crast or people like that who are very, have to ha have their shows done more than a year in advance and are very particular. But many of us are not. And my advice would be to not get stuck with that, because this show in Montreal about the race riots, for example, I wrote my grant and I said I was going to do abstract figurative form. I've never done abstract figurative. I'm going to do this, da, da, da. And then after months of mucking around and not being able to do abstract figurative form, I realized this is not about abstract figurative form. And I changed my whole concept. As long as you tell your grantor, hey, I've changed the concept, this is happening, they're cool. So don't get hung up with, I have to have it all figured out before I start. You don't. You don't.
Absolutely. And then often the grant process or the grant allows the artist to be able to figure it out. That's part of the process.
That's right. Yeah. But you can't just say, I want to play. You have to have some direction. So just choose something that you think might happen and work towards it. I mean, I think that's what we all do in our studios anyway, really. Maybe, maybe not.
Like a lot of people might be touching on ChatGPT and some of these AI things to write. Have you got any thoughts about how to use or how to not use something like that in your work?
That is really interesting. I taught a course last fall, and I asked people to submit things, and I was kind of astounded at the quality of the writing. And then it turned out that, everyone had run their stuff through ChatGPT, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. But then I also had recently been on a jury this year where I didn't notice it, but another, you're in a group when you're evaluating things, and other people said, oh, this is clearly ChatGPT. And I was like, really? How can you tell? And I guess, I think if you're a professor or somebody who's reading a lot of these things, you can tell. So, but to answer your question, I mean, how do I tend to not use ChatGPT when I write. I tend to use it more as a research, almost the way I would use Google, but I think it's a sharper lens than Google. And it also gives me resources like reference book, what do you call them? Footnotes, endnotes to follow the rabbit trail. I think, but I do think it is a good tool for people who are not very confident in their writing, but they should read it out loud and make sure it sounds like it's their voice and
Absolutely.
change it appropriately.
I think of ChatGPT or stuff like that, Claude or some of the other ones, is really like a research assistant or in this an art assistant that I might have. I might say to an assistant, hey, let's write this article or let's do some research on this. And they would go off and do their thing. And now with systems like that, you're able to do that almost with the press of a button. But you're right. You really do have to bring your own voice to the situation.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I was having a really hard time coming up with titles for this last show. So I just started describing my work and saying, what would be a good title? And it came up with a bunch of ideas. I'm like, and some of the words were nice, some of them not, but it's an idea generator.
Absolutely, absolutely. Heidi, I think that's a great spot for us to stop because you, I think, have created lots of idea generation moments for people in this conversation. So I want to thank you immensely for coming on board with us and being part of the Color and Ceramics podcast. So thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you.